Funding for Capital Report is provided by the following. The Able Trust, believing growth of Florida's economy depends on a diverse and inclusive workforce. The Able Trust works with the business community to include talented Floridians with disabilities as vital team members. More information is at abletrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. From the state capitol, Florida Public Radio brings you Capitol Report.
Many of the students in storm-ravaged North Florida aren't back to classes yet, but that situation is rapidly getting better.
It's taken some creative thinking to make this work, but it's been a team effort, and I'm very thankful for that.
Also this week, Florida's former top emergency manager is now free to use a term frowned upon by the Scott administration.
Oh, I absolutely would say this is tied to climate change.
We'll also get into a bit of Florida politics as we head into the last weekend before next Tuesday's critical midterm election. And we'll talk to some people who have adopted children, as well as one young lady who was herself adopted, as we celebrate National Adoption Month. I'm Tom Flanagan. This is Capitol Report. Panhandle schools hit hard by Hurricane Michael are reopening, and many students are experiencing a new normal as they return to the classroom. Ryan Daly reports some districts are having to get creative to get all students in the classroom. He recently spoke with two superintendents who are having to do just that.
Two North Florida counties, Jackson and Calhoun, returned to school this week, and the district superintendents both described a challenging road to recovery when it came to getting classrooms ready.
Every campus had some level of roof damage on buildings. We have five schools, and every campus had some amount of roof damage.
That's Calhoun County Superintendent Ralph Yoder. Calhoun County's elementary school took particularly bad damage and water intrusion. Yoder says the district is housing first through fifth grade on other campuses for now.
It's taken some creative thinking to make this work, but it's been a team effort, and I'm very thankful for that.
Yoder says the schools are, for the most part, fully staffed. In his words, he marvels at his staff's ability to bounce back.
Whenever I saw the carnage after the storm and the things that we were facing, I would not have put a date that we would have been started back on November 1st.
And some of the same creativity involved in getting kids back to school safely is applied in making sure the transition isn't too rough on families.
We do not want homework sent home until all power is on. We feel like that would be an unreasonable thing to do.
That's Jackson County Superintendent Larry Moore. In the week leading up to school's reopening, he was trying to ensure students got an extra chance to eat.
Currently have free lunches and free breakfasts, and met with some USDA representatives Monday, and we're looking into an evening, afternoon and evening snack and feeding type program where we can assist even more with nutrition.
Most public schools in Bay County, home to hard-hit Panama City, are set to reopen Monday. Others, the district says, are to be open no later than the following week. To house all students, some schools are having to split schedules. For instance, Arnold High School and Surfside Middle School are sharing the middle school's campus. Arnold High students will occupy the school from 7 in the morning until noon, and then Surfside Middle holds classes from 1 in the afternoon until 6 in the evening. Fielding many questions from parents on social media, the district posted some answers to frequent inquiries, like, "My child is going to middle school and will be getting off the bus and walking home in the dark. What can I do?" The district says it will be changing some of its bus routes to cut down on walking distance and providing reflective gear for bus riders. Like many counties battered by the storm, Bay had some damage to its buses. But out-of-county acts of kindness, like a donation of 20 buses from Pasco County Schools, have helped them get a plan in place. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Ryan Daly.
Weeks after Hurricane Michael made landfall in the Panhandle, some displaced residents say FEMA has been slow to respond. Former Florida Emergency Management Director Brian Kuhn says it's not that simple. Kuhn was one of Governor Rick Scott's first appointees in 2011. He may be best known for the controversy surrounding the Scott administration's unofficial edict banning the term climate change from official communications. Kuhn left his post after Hurricane Irma last year and is now an emergency management consultant. He still lives in Tallahassee, and he told Florida Public Radio's Gina Jordan, "We should expect that hurricanes may increase very rapidly in intensity from now on."
The warmer, the more energy in the ocean, particularly in the Gulf of Mexico. At this time of year, that's where hurricanes draw their energy from, and that's what's going to cause them to increase significantly in intensity.
I have to ask, would you call this climate change?
Oh, I absolutely would say this is tied to climate change.
Well, we're talking about Hurricane Michael. FEMA has repeatedly said that FEMA is the last option.
Mm-hmm.
They keep saying, you know, it's up to the state and local governments to respond first. Is that true?
That is true. I mean, that's how the system is designed. When the state gets overwhelmed, and as they do in a storm like Irma or Michael, that's when the federal government comes in to back them up. The State Emergency Management Agency has to leverage all of the other state agencies, the Department of Transportation, the Department of Children and Families, the Florida National Guard.
And then where does local government fall into all that?
Well, local government really should be driving the train on these kinds of things. They should be the ones who best understand, you know, in advance of the storm, what they need to do to prepare for it. And in those situations where they're not able to handle it, communicating to the state what their needs are.
So at what point is FEMA called in, and who makes that decision?
The governor of a state, in this case Governor Scott, had to request from the president that he declare a disaster. And once the president says, yes, I declare this a disaster, then FEMA gets to come in and start working with the state of Florida to help provide the resources necessary in that situation. Now, FEMA will lean forward in advance of that if they see a hurricane like Michael forming. But the official programs do not start until the president declares it a disaster.
We recently saw a letter from five members of Congress. They wanted FEMA to activate those trailers.
Mm-hmm.
And it looks like that's finally happening. But is that a state call? Is that a federal call?
It's going to be a negotiation. It will be the state and the federal government working together to analyze what the needs are there locally. There's a reticence to use trailers because they are expensive and sometimes the supply perhaps is limited. There might be an issue right now because this, you know, Michael came on the heels of Florence and they're also using trailers in North Carolina. So there might be a supply side issue. They have put people up in hotels, but there is a lack of available hotels in this area. So you need to use the trailer. It can either be like a mobile home or a travel trailer option. But you're going to have to come up with a different solution for somebody who is a renter. FEMA can give you money to go rent another place. Sometimes the federal government will rent a building and let people stay there. So they can directly rent a large apartment complex or housing complex and put people up.
So when a local government is badly damaged and they just really can't make any decisions about how recovery should be handled,
mm-hmm.
can FEMA just step right in?
No. No, and nor do you want them to. Nobody wants the federal government to take over your community. You don't want the federal or the state government coming in and taking over your community. You prefer that to remain local.
Working in this process, if you could make some changes that would make the whole hurricane response process faster,
mm-hmm.
what would you do?
For me, it comes down to how quickly can we get support and information down to the local resident, be they a renter, a homeowner, et cetera. The frustrating part to me has always been the bureaucratic process of getting the information to folks and letting them know what their choices are. The way the system works by design is that you try to use one solution. If that doesn't work, you go to the next one and then you try the next one. So in this one, it's temporary shelters or temporary assistance to stay in a hotel and now the travel trailers. So what you're unable to do is within a few days of the storm, go to that survivor and say, in addition to we hope you have insurance, here's some other programs that you may be able to take advantage of. If I were president for a day or speaker of the House for a day or whatever, I would try to compress that timeline so that we can more quickly take the appropriate action and help them understand what their choices are. They might not like all of the available options, but at least they would have the information necessary to determine what they're going to do for themselves and their family.
All right. Brian Kuhn, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
That was Florida's former Emergency Management Director, Brian Kuhn, speaking with Florida Public Radio's Gina Jordan. Still to come on Capitol Report. Once again, Florida's voters are pivotal in this upcoming election. Just ask Yamiche Alcindor from the PBS NewsHour what she thinks of Florida's U.S. Senate contest.
If the Republicans can actually pick up that seat, that's going to be a good thing for them to be able to just get their majority more in line.
It's National Adoption Month. We'll find out what it's like not only to adopt a child, but also what it's like to be a child who's looking to be adopted.
Is this really the one? Is this unconditional? Am I going to be moved? You know, are they going to give up on me?
Sometimes a disaster can help folks appreciate the simpler things in life, like visiting a laundromat.
Well, it gives people just that opportunity, if you want to say, to refresh themselves. I mean, they can come in here and at least have clean clothes.
And we'll discover our recent hurricane caused significant damage for an endangered Florida bird species.
Lots of tree damage, habitat damage, whole stands of timber completely blown down.
Republicans and Democrats may seem all fired up for this election cycle, but will that excitement actually be translated into votes? Florida Public Radio's Lynn Hatter spoke with PBS NewsHour's Yamiche Alcindor about what's at stake in this year's midterms.
I want to start with the gubernatorial race, because what is the national significance? You have Stacey Abrams in Georgia and Andrew Gillum in Florida. They're both running as progressive Democrats in the South. What's the national significance of their runs?
Well, there are a couple things. First, it's very easy to see that both of them, if elected, would be the first African-American governors of both of those states. That's a big deal, because African-Americans typically have not been in the governor's mansions in this country. So there's this idea that people see them as a continuation of almost this Obama generation, where we're seeing a more diverse candidate pool than ever before. The second thing is that they're running as progressive and running really as Democrats who are unashamed of talking about the policies that I think sometimes Democrats have stayed away from, not because they didn't believe in them, but because they were worried that they were going to be seen as too liberal. In Andrew Gillum's case, he's talking about paying for health care for all. He's talking about college. He's talking about really a Bernie Sanders type of platform. And that is something that is seen by Democrats in Florida as exciting. The other thing is, of course, that in Stacey Abrams' race, you're talking about voter suppression and issues there, because her opponent is seen by some as possibly suppressing votes of people in a race that he's running for himself. And then with Andrew Gillum, you have this kind of racial tension in that race, because you had his opponent saying very early on that he doesn't want to monkey up the race with Andrew Gillum.
Flipping to Florida's Senate race, how could that affect the makeup of the U.S. Senate and by extension national policy? Because here you have Bill Nelson, and then you have our current governor, Republican Governor Rick Scott.
It's hugely significant. Republicans have always, in some ways, been looking at the Senate and saying, well, even if we lose the House, we can keep the Senate. But I think if Rick Scott wins, that's going to be even more of a certain thing, because Bill Nelson has been this longtime Democrat that has been sitting in that Senate seat for decades, and has been someone who has widely been popular. But Rick Scott, of course, was governor of Florida, so he's also seen as widely popular. So if the Republicans can actually pick up that seat, that's going to be a good thing for them to be able to just get their majority more in line. Because even now, Republicans say that their Senate majority, is too close. You think of the Kavanaugh confirmation hearings, and they had to really make sure almost every single Republican was on the same page, because their majority is so slim. So if Rick Scott comes in there and there's another Supreme Court justice, that's just one more Republican vote that they can likely count on.
Now, the state of Florida itself has been under Republican leadership for the past 20 years, and this is the strongest slate of Democratic candidates that the state has had in the past two decades. Is Florida an outlier, or are Democrats actually running with momentum in places that they weren't before?
Democrats are definitely running in places where they didn't have momentum before. Just in my own reporting, I was in West Virginia and I was in Orange County, California. These are two districts that I covered personally where they were seen as solidly red. In Orange County, you have Dana Rohrabacher, who's been in Congress for decades, who is seen as someone who's a supporter of the president, who has been a supporter in defending the president when it comes to questions about Russia. And now he's in the fight for his life. And Hillary Clinton won that district in 2016. So he's in this fight because largely of President Trump and Republican voters looking at the president and saying he might be too brash. I'm not sure if I can support someone who is also going to support the president. Same thing is happening in West Virginia. I'm in a third congressional district there. And there's a Democrat named Richard Ojeda who's running and has kind of a brash style of politics that echoes President Trump. And people like the fact that they feel like he's someone who's off the cuff and real, but they also are voting for him because they think that that's someone who isn't going to support President Trump. So Republicans are definitely having problems, and that's largely because people either like President Trump a lot or they dislike him a lot.
That was Florida Public Radio's Lynn Hatter speaking with PBS NewsHour's Yamiche Alcindor. There are more than 400,000 American children in foster care, more than 25,000 of them in Florida. Their average length of stay is just over 25 months, according to the Ackerman Institute for the Family, and they have rates of post-traumatic stress disorder similar to combat veterans. We say all this because this is the beginning of National Adoption Month. Shannon Carroll owns and operates Redemptive Love Farm in Tallahassee. She and her husband have adopted 7 children and fostered many more. They've cared for children with cerebral palsy, muscular dystrophy, and PTSD, including trauma to survivors of child sexual abuse. One of the kids she adopted had been in a hospital for 10 years, despite the best medical care, and had cerebral palsy and was being fed through a tube.
And I prayed and I thought, I am not a nurse. I can't do this. I am not equipped for a child of this kind of care level. And somebody who is dear to me said, you know, this child's problem is not that she needs more nurses, that she needs more doctors, that she needs more therapists. Her problem is that she's an orphan and she needs a mom and a dad. And so that's where we stepped in. I could be a mother.
Michelle Scott came into foster care at the age of 3 and was adopted at age 8. In between, she had 14 placements. Now about to graduate from Florida State University, she says she tested her adoptive parents at first.
Is this really the one? Is this unconditional? Am I going to be moved? Are they going to give up on me? I know that that's happened to a lot of adoptive parents and, stay with them. Keep loving them. Keep showing them that you are there. You want to keep them in your life forever. You're not going to give up on them.
The effects of trauma are profound, says Jane Johnson, director of advocacy at the Florida Council for Community Mental Health. Also a guardian ad litem representing a child with developmental disabilities, she's seen it up close.
He's had probably over 30 placements since he's been in foster care, but he doesn't believe anyone can love him because life to this point and for him has shown him that he's not lovable.
Johnson says children in the system often need quality trauma-informed care to counteract the scarring of their brains and their hearts. Marty Gillen, who teaches children, trauma, and resiliency at the University of Florida, agrees.
So we need to change our lens, and instead of saying, what's wrong with you? Why on earth are you acting this way? We need to look at what happened to that child for them to exhibit the behaviors they're doing.
Gillen says if foster and adoptive parents view a child's behavior as willful disobedience, they'll be harsher as a result.
But if I view this behavior as survival, and thank goodness that child has that behavior because they survived and they're here today because of that, then I take a totally different parenting approach.
Mary Kay Wimsett is an attorney in Northeast Florida who has finalized more than 3,000 adoptions. While not everyone can take in a child, everyone can do something to reduce the number of abused and neglected children without families. For instance, Gator Strong Families, which serves University of Florida foster families, posts their needs from car seats to cribs to meals to a night off.
There's a family that just took placement of 5 siblings, and can't someone bring them dinner tonight? So we had a foster mom recently who donated her kidney to one of the children in her foster home, and the community came together, and we provided meals for them for, I think, 3 or 4 months.
For those who care but aren't inclined or equipped to foster or adopt, there's another option, say all of those whose voices appeared in this report. It's volunteering as a guardian ad litem. Children with a guardian to advocate for them are twice as likely to be adopted as those without. And of course, there are also all those nonprofits that support kids in foster care with everything from school supplies to scholarships. They are always looking for financial support. Before we leave the subject of Hurricane Michael, with which we started off this week's Capitol Report, you might not give your clean clothes a second thought. And if you've just lived through a Category 4 hurricane, doing a load of wash might not be a priority or even be possible. In Port St. Joe, member station WUFT's Sophia Millar visited the laundry basket. As the only operational laundromat for miles, it's doing a brisk business while also doubling as a social gathering place.
Hurricane Michael left many in the Florida panhandle picking up pieces. The sounds of generators are the only ones you'll hear, as many are without electricity, gas, or water. This means hot days, cold showers, and fewer everyday comforts.
It was overwhelming when we first got back, but it's almost like you're kind of getting a little numb to it.
That's Karen Reed.
You just kind of gotta pull up your pants and keep on going, because you don't really have a choice.
She's a business owner in the small town of Port St. Joe.
We had puddles when we got here. It smelled because it was closed up and the air wasn't running, so it had kind of a funky smell, but we mopped and mopped and used dehumidifiers.
She owns the laundry basket. It's the only working laundromat that can be found for miles.
The other laundromat in Mexico Beach isn't there anymore. The one in Wewahitchka, or the two in Wewahitchka, have no power, so I'm the only one that's up and running in this whole area. So we've been busy.
Now that she's up and running herself, Karen's helping others the only way she knows how.
We've had everything from we've had no damage to I've lost everything, and this is what I have. I've had people coming from Panama City, Callaway, Parker, Wewahitchka, everywhere.
From 8 a.m. to 6 p.m., everyday people who've never stepped foot inside a laundromat can now be seen folding their clothes.
I don't spend a whole lot of time in town. I have too much to do at home.
Dennis Thorne lives about 30 minutes away in St. Joe Beach. He normally doesn't come into the main town, but when he drove in to pick up supplies from the hardware store, he noticed the laundromat was open.
Well, it gives people just that opportunity, if you want to say, to refresh themselves. I mean, they can come in here and at least have clean clothes. And that's basically what I'm doing. It's just trying to keep up with some routine, if you want to say, of life.
Since reopening, Karen says she's met hundreds of people, just like Dennis, from all walks of life and with all types of baggage.
Some people come with just one load, because either it's all they have or it's all they can carry or all they can deal with.
Melanie Gant has much more than just one load. After all, she has five children.
I got a bed in my truck is full of laundry and stuff that got wet because our roof got messed up and a lot of our stuff got wet.
Her house is livable, but she's already spent 6 hours at the laundry basket and will likely spend many more. Hurricane destruction doesn't stop the dirty laundry from piling up.
My washing machine is not usable at the moment, and they're the only laundromat in town. They're it.
It'll take time to rebuild the hurricane-ravaged town of Port St. Joe, but it may not look like the same place where many grew up and raised their families.
There'll be familiar faces that are gone, and, you know, hopefully they'll find something better.
For those who have come back, hopefully the laundry basket can help those recovering feel like they've returned home. Even if it is one load at a time.
That was Sophia Millar at member station WUFT in Gainesville. You're listening to Capitol Report from Florida Public Radio. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, people weren't the only victims of Hurricane Michael. Eleanor Clark reports endangered woodpeckers are in trouble following the storm, and biologists are racing to keep the species alive.
Wildlife technician Brenton Holt is surveying damage at the Apalachicola National Forest. He says parts of the forest took the brunt of the storm's strong winds.
lots of tree damage, habitat damage, whole stands of timber completely blown down, similar to what you're seeing, you know, over in Calhoun County, and Jackson County, Bay County, where the eye of the storm went through.
That's a problem for a unique bird that calls the forest home. Red-cockaded woodpeckers, or RCWs, are an endangered species that love northwest Florida for its pine savanna ecosystems. They're picky birds, though. As the only woodpecker species that builds cavities for their nests into live pine trees, they also only use trees more than 60 years old. Before the storm, one area of the Apalachicola forest had 20 trees with woodpecker cavities, but after Hurricane Michael, Holt says only two of those trees are still standing. And he says the birds living in trees that were knocked over likely didn't survive. Rob Meyer is a biologist at Tall Timbers Research Station who also studies red-cockaded woodpeckers. He says even for birds who did survive the storm, the danger isn't over.
But the bigger issue is going to be the weeks after the storm where maybe some birds have to roost on limbs instead of in their cavities that have been knocked over. And so you could expect some mortality afterwards.
Without their cavity, the birds are vulnerable to attacks from owls, hawks, and even tree snakes. But biologists are working fast to help the species recover. Their plans involve creating artificial cavities, called inserts, for the birds to nest in. Joel Casto is a Forest Service partner who spends a lot of time up in the trees inserting the cavities. He says the approach got its start in the wake of another devastating hurricane.
Putting in artificial inserts for red-cockaded woodpecker started back in Hurricane Hugo, the late 80s, early 90s, and has become the accepted quick way to provide a suitable cavity for RCWs all throughout the Southeast.
Meyer explains how the inserts work.
Essentially a bird box, but we actually put them inside the tree. And so what all of our biologists are trying to do right now are climb these trees with specialized ladders and with a chainsaw cut out this little box shape in a tree nearby so that we can just insert that box into the tree. And then we putty it up, make sure it stays in there. And then we kind of cover it up, make it look natural. And essentially we can give a bird a free home in about 30 minutes. Where it takes the bird naturally to make a single cavity, anywhere from 6 months to years to make a single cavity.
The Forest Service expects to place more than 400 cavities in the Apalachicola forest alone to make up for what was lost during Hurricane Michael. During a quiet moment at Tall Timbers, bugs chirp, birds call, and far off in the distance, a backhoe is salvaging downed trees to sell for timber. Recovery is just getting started for red-cockaded woodpeckers in the area. But there may be cause for optimism in the long term. Researchers say Northwest Florida's thousands of downed trees will serve as added fuel, creating hotter and more intense fires for the next few years. And for fire-dependent species, like the red-cockaded woodpecker, that's actually good news. For Florida Public Radio, I'm Eleanor Clark.
Regular Capitol Report correspondents are Ryan Daly, Lynn Hatter, Gina Jordan, and Regan McCarthy. We also thank Eleanor Clark and our contributing Florida Public Radio stations. Technical assistance for Capitol Report is provided by Ken Smith, and I'm Tom Flanagan. Follow us on Twitter at FPR Cap Report. And please join us each week at this time for more reports from the state capitol.
Audio copies of Capitol Report are available by calling 1-800-829-8809. You can also hear Capitol Report online, including archives of past shows, at wfsu.org. Funding for Capitol Report is provided by the following: The Able Trust, dedicated to connecting businesses and workers with disabilities. Businesses are encouraged to recruit, interview, and hire talented and loyal Floridians with disabilities as they seek to broaden their customer base and reach all of Florida's diverse population. AbleTrust.org. WFSU-FM, Tallahassee. This is Florida Public Radio.